Well, this is a good question, because when President Trump accepted to recognize the Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara in exchange of resuming ties or normalization, the normalization with Israel, that triggered something in that part of the world, because it means that Morocco is seeking this recognition and is supporting Israel, while Israel is accusing Algeria of being close to Iran. And we saw recently the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, who also accused Algeria of having a relationship with Iran and is supporting Morocco against Algeria. And I think the Israelis, wherever there is a possibility to put oil on fire, they really don't pull back. On the contrary, they move forward because they want other African countries to follow suit the decision of the King Mohammed of Morocco in relation to Israel, of course.
South Africa, considered one of the most powerful countries in the continent, has been at the forefront advocating for the end of Morocco's rule over the Western Sahara region. Speaking when he hosted Sahrawi leader Brahim Ghali, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said he is certain that the people of Western Sahara will eventually get self-determination and be free.
The suffering that the people of Sahrawi are going through now in refugee camps will be sufficient evidence that indeed this colonization should come to an end. Because it is an affront to us as the people of Africa that we should, in this day and age, still have one country within the African continent that does not have self-determination, that is not independent.
Algeria, just like many African countries, backs the independence of the Western Sahara region currently occupied by Morocco. How will this issue affect Morocco's ties with other African countries, especially after the US recognized Rabat's claim over the region?
It will affect it because the Algeria stand is with the Palestinian movement, with the Palestinian cause, with Gaza and with the Palestinian state. And by the recognition of Morocco over the Western Sahara and the acknowledgement of Morocco to normalize with Israel, that deeply affects the position in favor of the Palestinian right of return, right of state, and the Palestinian cause, and recognize what Israel is doing to the Palestinian. And that seriously affects the position, particularly when these countries are in harmony with Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, and other countries that support the Palestinian cause.
Algerian Foreign Minister has warned that insistence on granting Israeli regime observer status at the African Union could lead to the disintegration of this continental body. Algiers is leading a group of powerful African countries opposing Israel's observer status in this pan-African body.
Now, last question to you. What are some of the regional implications for Algeria's decision to cut ties with Morocco, especially considering the fact that Algiers is leading a campaign to reject Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union?
Well, the consequences will be on Morocco's economic situation, because apart from the borders between Algeria and Morocco are closed since 1994, however, there is a gas line, there's a Morocco-Europe pipeline that goes from Algeria through Morocco to Spain, and that was supposed to start in October 2021, and Algeria is going to bypass it and use the Medgaz without going through Morocco, and that will affect the Moroccan economy because of the unilateral decision of Morocco to normalize with Israel. And also it will affect the trade between Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Mauritania, Morocco, Morocco, because the level of trade today is around 2.8 percent, and it was due to raise into 6 to 10%. Therefore, all this because of Morocco's decision to normalize with Israel, the Algerian reaction will give a certain example what can happen to other African countries if they resume normalization with Israel. And there are going to be counter reaction from those who don't want to normalize with Israel and believe in the rightness of the Palestinian cause.
While it's quite evident that the Israeli regime is pursuing a devious plan of sowing the seeds of discord in Africa, and this can only be to the detriment of African countries and the Palestinian cause. Thanks a lot for your incisive analysis. We shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about France's dirty secrets in Niger. Stay with us.
Radioactive legacy in Niger.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Niger, a landlocked nation in West Africa, has some of the world's largest uranium reserves, around 7% of the global total. Now, uranium is used to fuel nuclear power plants, which are mostly located in European, North American, and some Asian countries.
Production of uranium at the Cominak mine in Niger's Agadez region came to an end in March this year after over 40 years of operations. During the four decades, the mining operations by this French company produced more than 75,000 tons of elemental uranium. However, the company's plan for dismantling the mine site has been termed as unsatisfactory by the local population and environmentalists. The main disagreement is the management of massive radioactive waste stored in the open air. Uranium mining operations in Niger have left behind a trail of poverty and environmental destruction.
Now, to discuss more on French-owned uranium mines in Niger and the pain and suffering they have brought for the people of this impoverished country, we have contacted Eric Welbeck, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, first, how is the radioactive waste from the abandoned mines affecting the people of this part of Niger?
You look at the way it's mined, and it's devastating. It's the open pit mines ruin the environment, great amounts of radioactive dust are constantly swirling around in the desert climate, like Niger, where there's wind sweeping. It's constantly in people's lungs. The rate of cancer is very alarmingly high, and especially lung cancer. And it's not only the use of these radioactive materials, which can be up to 500 times the safe level, but it's also the use of the groundwater. Millions of liters of groundwater. It's in a desert, and all the water is being used to create uranium. So really, the waste effects are ongoing now.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Welbeck, for your insight.
Though Niger got its independence in the 1960s, France still plays an influential role in the country, thereby playing a monopoly game to tap its natural resources. Since the discovery of uranium in Niger, a major chunk of this mineral has been exclusively exported to France by Areva, the state-owned nuclear power company of France. Locals who worked in the mines are suffering from unknown diseases and say that they are treated like animals by French companies running the uranium mines. French companies own most of the uranium mines in Niger, including the abandoned Comanac mine. Are these companies carrying out their responsibility to clean up their mess?
People live in terror of, they're afraid to speak out. The journalists wanted to come and interview people, and they said, don't say you're talking about uranium. You want to say you're talking about migrant laborers leaving our lit to go to Algeria because they've got no work. You can talk about that, but don't. So it's very much in the old vision of how, especially in the United States, where reporters would try and investigate and they would be killed. Or you could say, you know, it's going on everywhere in the world, that reporters really are intimidated into not reporting the news. So the French is not, the company is not responsible, and so it tries to hide that fact. So, this company, the original contract was made in 1968, and when finally, through Freedom of Information or through Doctors Without Borders, they were able to get evidence of what the actual contract was. It was all secret. And it turns out there were no taxes being paid, no excise taxes, no use of local resources. Basically, it was a free ride for this powerful company, which is one of the richest in the world. So it's siphoning all the wealth to its own, to France and to its shareholders and whatever, and leaving the people, as I said, Niger is the 187th out of 188. It's right at the bottom of the UN Human Development Index. So it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Niger, with a population of more than 23 million, remains one of the poorest countries on the planet as per the Development Index of the United Nations. More than 43% of its population is living below $1.25 per day. French companies mining uranium in Niger are not only looting the country's wealth, but they have destroyed the environment.
Now, uranium in Niger was supposed to be a blessing for the people, but apparently this wealth is now a curse, as masses languish in poverty while foreign countries, especially France, make massive profits from this natural resource. What went wrong?
Well, it's the it used to be called, or it still is called, the oil curse. And originally that was a name that was given to the Dutch, who had some oil in Holland, and they started, after World War II, started to mine it. But it turned out that it created horrible pollution, and the profits just went to the, all the benefit went to the so-called shareholders, to the owners of the company. And all it left behind was sickness. Oil is horrible. It's right up there with uranium. It's a poison, a toxin. And so it leaves the people sick, and it leaves the money in the mother country, in this case, in the case of Niger, France.
Well, French companies have exported billions of dollars worth of uranium from Niger over the years. In 2010, Greenpeace conducted an analysis in Niger and found that the uranium contamination in 4 out of 5 water samples exceeded World Health Organization safety limits. Now, is there hope that French mining companies will stop the pillage and destruction of Niger, and the people will eventually benefit from their country's uranium?
Really hard to fight a big company, and what we really need is to as part of this environmental movement now, we have to really, as this documentary is doing, is focus on these horrible violations of humanity that are done in the name of clean energy. There's nothing clean about what's going on in winter. And the hope is only through continual struggle and continual attempts to deal with these problems on a world scale. We must go back to the UN. All of these issues are really best met through a neutral international organization.
Well, there you have it. Mr. Wahlberg says neutral international organizations need to intervene and stop the plundering of countries like Niger, which are rich in natural resources but suffer exploitation by Western multinationals. And on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Let us know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media handle. Until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
The United States and Australia went to extraordinary lengths to keep Paris in the dark as they secretly negotiated a plan to build nuclear submarines, scuttling France's largest defense contract and so enraging President Emmanuel Macron that on Friday, 17th of September, he ordered the withdrawal of France's ambassadors to both nations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David E. Sanger. The piece is titled Secret Talks and a Hidden Agenda Behind the U.S. Defense Deal That France Called a Betrayal. The United States and Australia went to extraordinary lengths to keep Paris in the dark as they secretly negotiated a plan to build nuclear submarines, scuttling France's largest defense contract and so enraging President Emmanuel Macron that on Friday, 17th of September, he ordered the withdrawal of France's ambassadors to both nations. President Emmanuel Macron's decision was a stunning and unexpected escalation of the breach between Washington and Paris, on a day that the two countries had planned to celebrate an alliance that goes back to the defeat of Britain in the Revolutionary War. Yet, it was driven by France's realization that two of its closest allies had been negotiating secretly for months. According to interviews with American and British officials, the Australians approached the new administration soon after President Biden's inauguration and said they had concluded that they had to get out of a $60 billion agreement with France to supply them with a dozen attack submarines. The conventionally powered French submarines, the Australians feared, would be obsolete by the time they were delivered. They expressed interest in seeking a fleet of quieter nuclear-powered submarines based on American and British designs that could patrol areas of the South China Sea with less risk of detection. but it was unclear how they would terminate the agreement with France, which was already over budget and running behind schedule. They told us that they would take care of dealing with the French, one senior US official said. The Australians knew they had a receptive audience. President Biden, who had made pushing back hard on China's territorial ambitions a central tenet of his national security policy, told aides those French-made submarines would not do. They did not have the ability to range the Pacific and show up unexpectedly off Chinese shores, adding an element of military advantage for the West. The Australians, by all accounts, never made clear to the French that they were preparing to cancel the deal, which had taken years to negotiate. And in meeting after meeting with their French counterparts, some including President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the Americans did not give French a heads up about their plans to step in with their own designs, the official said, asking for anonymity to discuss sensitive diplomacy. It was a classic case of diplomatic avoidance. President Biden's top aides finally discussed the issue with the French just hours before it was publicly announced at the White House in a virtual meeting with President Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. The result was a blow-up that has now led to a vivid breach of trust with one of America's oldest allies. In the end, President Biden's decision was the result of a brutal calculus that nations sometimes make, in which one ally is determined to be more strategically vital than another, something national leaders and diplomats never like to admit in public. And it was a sign that as President Biden begins to execute what the Obama administration 12 years ago called the pivot to Asia, there is the risk of stepping on political landmines as old traditional allies in Europe feel left behind. As much as the pivot has been described as pivoting to Asia without pivoting away from someplace else, that is just not possible. Richard Fontaine, the chief executive of the Center for a New American Security, who has long ties to both the Australian and American players in the deal, announced on Wednesday. Military resources are finite. Doing more in one area means doing less in others. It also apparently means hiding negotiations from some of your closest allies. By the time the Biden administration began engaging Australia and Britain seriously about its emerging strategy to counter China, a three-year-old contract worth $60 billion or more for a dozen submarines to be constructed largely by the French was already teetering, American officials said. The submarines were based on a propulsion technology that was so limited in range and so easy for the Chinese to detect that it would be obsolete by the time the first submarines were put in the water, perhaps as long as 15 years from now. There was an obvious alternative, the kind of nuclear-powered submarines deployed by the Americans and the British. But American and Australian officials agreed that if the French caught wind of the fact that the plug was going to be pulled on one of the biggest defense contracts in their history, they almost certainly would try to sabotage the alternative plan, according to officials who were familiar with the discussions between Washington and Canberra. So they decided to keep the work to a very small group of officials and made no mention of it to the French, even when President Biden and Antony Blinken met their French counterparts back in June. President Biden made no mention of the plans during the chummy chat with President Emmanuel Macron at a summit meeting in June in Cornwall in Britain, where they sat in lawn chairs by the sea and talked about the future of the Atlantic Alliance. Joe Biden, Boris Johnson, and Scott Morrison met together the same day, discuss the emerging deal, and, in a vague statement which seems more revealing today than it did then, referred to deepening strategic cooperation between the three governments to meet a changing defense environment in the Indo-Pacific. Just 3 days later, Scott Morrison met separately with Emmanuel Macron, but left no impression he was rethinking the deal, the French insist. According to French officials, Anthony Blinken also stayed silent on 25th of June, when his French counterpart Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian welcomed him back to Paris, where Anthony Blinken spent his high school years, and extolled the importance of the French submarine deal. And as recently as 30th of August, when the French and Australian Defence and Foreign Ministers held their annual consultation, they issued a joint communique that said the two countries were committed to deepening cooperation in the defence industry and underlined the importance of the future submarine programme. By that time, the Australians not only knew the programme was dead, they had nearly sealed the agreement in principle with Washington and London. The French ambassador to the United States, Philippe Etienne, said in several interviews that he first heard of the deal in leaked news reports appearing in the Australian media and in the website Politico. Other French officials said they had been suspicious that something was up a week ago, but did not get an immediate response from Anthony Blinken or the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. The first American official to discuss the details with Ambassador Philippe Etienne was Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, just a few hours before the public announcement on Wednesday. American officials insist it was not their place to talk to the French about their business deal with Australia. But now, in the light of the blow-up, some officials say they regret that they did not insist that the Australians level with the French about their intentions earlier. The Chinese government also did not get a heads up, no surprise since the official American position is that the submarine deal is not aimed at any particular nation. But China's first response to the new alliance, awkwardly named AUKUS, for Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, was that it was extremely irresponsible and would start an arms race. In fact, the Pentagon's most recent China report says the Chinese Navy has built a dozen nuclear submarines, some of which can carry nuclear weapons. Australia has vowed never to deploy nuclear weapons. Even before Emmanuel Macron recalled the ambassadors from Washington and Canberra, Joe Biden's aides seemed taken back by the ferocity of the French response, especially Jean-Yves Le Drian's characterization that it was a knife in the back. They have suggested the French were being overly dramatic and believed the two countries will gradually return to normal relations. History suggests they may be right. A huge breach prompted by the British and French invasion of the Suez Canal in 1956 was eventually papered over, as was the Nixon shock with the Japanese in 1971, when the United States gave no notice about its decision to come off the gold standard. In this case, American officials said the decision to toss over the existing French-Australian contract and replace it with one that would bind Australia technologically and strategically to the nuclear submarine program generated virtually no internal debate. The reason was straightforward. In the Biden White House, the imperative to challenge China's growing footprint and its efforts to push the U.S. Navy east to the next island chain in the Pacific reigns supreme. It says a lot about how Washington discerns its interests in the Pacific, said Mr. Fontaine, that there was no hand-wringing about angering the French. Yet for years, American officials have known that the turn towards Asia could strain relations with European allies. While former President Barack Obama initially embraced the phrase "the pivot" to describe the American move to the region of the world where its economic and strategic interests are greatest, as a basketball player, he latched on to the sports metaphor. His White House eventually banned the public use of the phrase because of European objections. That did not stop Kurt Campbell, a major architect of the strategy, from publishing a 2016 book about it, The Pivot, The Future of American Statecraft in Asia, which was advertised as an account of a necessary course correction for American diplomacy, commercial engagement, and military innovations.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, aspects and principles of conduct. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, we said that the roots of conduct or our relationships as human beings have four aspects. The first one is conduct with Allah, our Creator, the beneficent, the merciful. Our contact and conduct and relationship with Allah. The second one is our conduct and relationship with the self. The third one is our conduct with creation, that is people around us, others. Last but not the least is the conduct with this world, the rest of the world. We have covered the first two types and went over the principles, the governing principles for the two types of conducts, the conduct with Allah and the self. Now let's move on to the third one, which is the conduct with the creation. Brothers and sisters, each one of these aspects is based upon seven principles, according to some scholars. The seven principles of conduct with the creation are, number one, forbearance. We have to be following forbearance and practicing forbearance in our lives. Number two is forgiveness. Yes, people make mistakes. You know, not everybody can fulfill and act based on our expectations. So be forgiving the way you expect Allah to be forgiving towards you. Forgive other people's mistakes. The third one is humility. Be humble. Don't just act all haughty and arrogant. This is not something Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala likes. So our relationship with the other creation is supposed to be a humble relationship. Be down to earth. And people who are down to earth, they get respected too. Welcome back to your listeners. We are discussing the aspects and principles of conduct. And out of the four types of conducts or relationships or contexts that human beings have, we are covering the third one, which is conduct with the creation, that is people. Now, there are seven principles for each one of these conducts. And we have discussed the three principles for the conduct with the creation. Let's move on to the fourth one. It's generosity. Brothers and sisters, there are some qualities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prescribed for human beings, and He loves to see those qualities in human beings. One of them is being generous. See, all the wealth, all the material blessings that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us or bestowed upon us. It is a trust of Allah. Allah wants us to spend all of those blessings in His way, benefiting other human beings and helping them out in their everyday lives. Be generous. The next principle, the governing principles of conduct with the creation, is compassion. Again, compassion towards others, feeling the pain of the others. Look at what's happening in Yemen, for instance. Where is our voice in support of Yemen? And where is our opposition against the oppressors, let it be Saudis or America, right? This compassion is something of utmost importance that makes us human beings. Good counsel, help others, give them advice, you know, bid the good and forbid the evil. Last but not the least is justice and fairness. Be just in your lives. Be fair in your lives. Do not overstep your boundaries. Do not misuse your powers. This is the last principle of conduct with the creation and the rest of the world and the people. Inshallah, we will talk about the last aspect and principle of conduct, the root of conduct, which is conduct with this world, in the next episode. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
May 7th, 2021. During the revolutionary movement, some were telling Imam Khomeini, may God be pleased with him, that he was causing the best young people to get killed. Look at these pressures that are brought in the form of prudence and caution. This is the great and beautiful patience that Imam Hussein had. And then his companions are killed, one by one, in that horrible situation. This is like someone whose body is cut up into pieces little by little. It was like this for Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura. It was not like a bomb that fell and killed some people. No, every one of his companions who was killed, every one of the members of his household who was killed, it was as if a part of the Imam's blessed body was cut off. And the Imam was patient during each of these events, one by one. He sipped at patience, drop by drop. This movement was this great, and the result was clear. As a result, those values that Imam Hussain wanted to remain in the world remained. The Quran, the name of Islam, the values of Islam, the traditions of the Prophet, and in a more limited and important way, Shiism, which is the school of the household of the Prophet, all remained. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. If Imam Hussain had not acted in this way, the situation would have been different, and all of Islam would have been destroyed. It would have been destroyed in the same way that during the 50 or 60 years after the demise of the Prophet. Islam had changed to the point where they could kill the dearest member of the family of the Prophet. Well, the situation had changed significantly. I have already explained this matter in detail one time. The Islamic world had reached the point where they could openly kill or take captive Imam Hussein, Lady Zainab al-Kubra, the children of the Prophet, and the dearest family of the Prophet. The situation must have changed significantly, and afterwards, in a short time, it could have gotten even worse, and Islam could have been completely eliminated. In fact, Imam Hussein acted like a huge stake that held down the tent of Islam, which a storm was uprooting. He kept it with his blood. Well, this is the greatest epic in the history of Islam, even the greatest epic throughout all of history. This must be preserved. This must be kept alive. This should be used for solving all the affairs of the Muslims, wherever they are in history.
In the limelight. Global investment demand for gold has increased at an average of 18% each year since 2000, and a World Gold Council study found that 61% of respondents trust gold more than fiat currencies. Stay with us for an article written by Sylvia Carrasco. The piece is titled, Next Generation of Super Apps to Focus on Gold Trading. The article has been taken from the website of the Asia Times. The dominance of the super app is already unfolding in Asia, which is leading the way for the rest of the world. These super apps represent the next frontier in consumer technology, becoming so deeply integrated into the consumer's life that they become indispensable operating systems. It is clear that their success primarily originates from a native mobile payment system. FinTech integration has been a core accelerating factor, and for the next generation of super apps, offering gold trading matters more than ever. Super apps need no introduction in Asia. WeChat hosts more than a billion users, and there have been multiple super apps established throughout emerging markets, including Grab, Gojek, Kakao, and Alipay. Users can talk with friends, order food, or book a flight, all within one app and without having to switch to any others. The app becomes a multifaceted marketplace rather than a single service offering. A native mobile payment system has been a crucial ingredient to rapid scalability, allowing one single-purpose applications to partner with various businesses and offer hundreds of products and services within a single app. By comparison, financial technology is a late-blooming industry. App-based finance was a relative latecomer to digitization, with a significant level of mistrust for digital banking and an ingrained loyalty to long-established traditional banks, with face-to-face appointments preferred. However, there were signs that the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the shift towards digitization. A report by Baker and McKenzie showed that within the Asia-Pacific region, the pace of digital transformation has been increasing because of the impact of COVID-19, with 92% of business leaders reevaluating their digital strategies and optimizing digital infrastructure to remain competitive in response to the pandemic. This recent shift has primed the fintech landscape to offer an expansion of their services, and startups are now competing to build out their product suites to meet increasing demand. The new generation of app users want everything ideally in one place, with minimal friction, and at the same time are more focused on their personal finance than ever before. The behavior and habits of Asia-Pacific finance consumers are rapidly evolving, with the new generation wanting to use a new suite of digital banking options, including challenger banks and fintech firms, that are willing to meet their banking needs. McKinsey, the trusted advisor and counselor to many of the world's most influential businesses and institutions, reports that digital natives, those born between 1980 and 2012, including Generation Z and Millennials, are likely to drive Asia's consumption over the coming decade, as they make up more than one-third of Asia's consumer population. A recent report found that 20 to 30% of this generation spends more than 6 hours a day on their mobile phones, and more than 70% of them are very confident of meeting their financial goals. This is where the developers of the next generation of super apps need to think about the financial products that they are offering. As fintechs look to expand their global reach and product depth, sooner or later, they will need to offer alternative wealth and investment products, so it's only a matter of time until they look to allocated gold. Global investment demand for gold has increased at an average of 18% each year since 2000, and a World Gold Council study found that 61% of respondents trust gold more than fiat currencies. Investors are more tuned in than ever before to innovative ways of managing their portfolios through turbulence. The recent implementation of Basel III Accord pushes the industry towards physical gold over paper, and demand for the precious metal increased by 40% from 2019 to 2020. Business-to-consumer fintechs are racing to build their product suites. It's a game of survival of the fittest. Companies are looking for geographical domination and expansion of their product offering. Lose the game, and their users will flip over to the next platform. B2B or business-to-business integrations enable super app providers to capitalize on the huge demand for allocated gold from fintech and operators of embedded finance. The firm I represent, Goldex, is already directly working with 20 fintech companies to provide a convenient option for allocated gold, creating a product that so far has no direct competition. Apps can offer their users allocated gold within 6 weeks. As the world increasingly moves towards the super app model, more companies will likely consider how they can integrate several services rather than focusing on the specialization of just one product. To tap into the full potential of global growth, services that offer business-to-business integration products that can deliver investment options like gold could shape the future of the fintech industry and the next generation of super apps.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
Farah appeals to Nyunga in her fifth grade of primary school, is one of hundreds of wounded children targeted by the Israeli regime. Shortly after the Israeli bombing of her house, Farah was transferred along with her mother and siblings to the hospital where their father.
Farah and her brothers and sisters were sleeping at home when the Israeli regime hit our house with no prior notice. They brought my kids to the very hospital where I work in. I was really shocked to see them. I've never expected to see my family in such a horrible condition. Farah was severely injured.
Farah, whose injury was highly critical, stayed for 7 days in a Shifa hospital, but her injury was severe and required traveling to Jordan for treatment. Unfortunately, all attempts failed to save Farah's legs, and she was eventually amputated.
Despite the fact that Farah has artificial legs, her morale is high. I thought that I would never see my child walking again, but now she's walking with her artificial legs.
Despite losing her legs, Farah is coming back from her treatment trip to take up her education in the school, where her teacher and classmates held a welcoming event for her.
I'm happy to be here and to see my friends once again. I'll do my best to continue my study. I know that I have to be strong and I will not give up my rights, whatever happens.
We held this ceremony to welcome Farah back from Jordan, where she spent a long treatment journey. Farah represents our Palestinian patience and resilience. She recovered from her injury and now is resuming her study. I have another 1,000 students here in this school, 20 of whom were injured during the latest Israeli escalation. Most of them have suffered from psychological stress.
Farah is now classified among a group of Palestinian children whose legs were amputated by the Israeli regime during the escalations over the Gaza Strip in serious violations of the right to life and childhood. Children in Gaza are one of the victims of the Israeli crimes. The regime has deprived them the right to live in safety. Nearly 70 children in Gaza were killed and hundreds were injured during the 2021 conflict. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions. But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margarita Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost €1 billion per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis. Activists claim the €6 billion would be better spent taking in desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter where when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
North Korea fired two ballistic missiles from a railway Wednesday. Hours later, South Korea conducted its own submarine-launched ballistic missile test, raising tension in the East Asian region. The U.S. singled out only North Korea's provocative behavior.
These launches are in violation of multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions. And these activities highlight the destabilizing impact of the DPRK's illicit weapons program.
North Korea remains under United Nations Security Council sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs, which prevent the country from conducting international trade and inhibits North Koreans' access to food, medicine, and other goods available in most countries. Analysts argue North Korea is being treated unfairly.
South Korea has various missiles at a significant level of development. For North Korea, the more that South Korea, needless to say, the U.S. shows such a two-faced and double-standard position, the more North Korea will develop missiles and nuclear weapons, which is not favorable for anyone. One should try to understand the situation from North Korea's position.
The U.S. has 28,500 troops stationed in South Korea, with Seoul purchasing the latest American missiles, jet fighters, and other weapons in a regional arms race. The missile tests by North and South Korea over the past couple of weeks are unprecedented in recent times. And security experts warn that because of the close proximity of the probable targets and the potential destructive power of the bombs likely to be deployed, the time to respond to a perceived threat decreases, and the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a broader conflict grows. Still, there is hope the U.S. and North Korea may be encouraged to engage in dialogue. China this week lobbied for negotiations with its foreign minister Wang Yi visiting Japan and South Korea for talks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon has received the first shipment of Iranian fuel since the beginning of a fuel crisis in the Mediterranean country. As tens of Syrian fuel tankers drove through Alain town in northern Bekaa, a solace of better days to come seemed to be stronger than the scent of diesel itself.
We declare that we have broken the U.S. siege, and now the resistance